Thank you for joining us on More Than That, a podcast where we dive a little bit deeper into what was preached on Sunday morning. We hope that this is enriching to your walk with Christ and that you love God and people that much more so that we can extend the glory of God to the people he has placed in our lives. So buckle up and enjoy the conversation. Hey, City Church, welcome back to More Than That. This week, we had an entire chapter within the series of sermons on the book of Nehemiah, and we had a person from the congregation who is very well known within the Williamsport area due to his alleged relationship to a certain very famous singer. Whether or not it's
actual. Not alleged, Taylor. Taylor Swift is definitely my cousin. I have proven this with clearly not Photoshopped pictures.
So Peter had the opportunity to present to us chapter 3, which has a ton of really fun names along with some really cool little tidbits. So Peter, if you had an extra 10 minutes or so that you wanted to unpack something new or dive a little bit deeper or really like press in on something, what would that have been?
Yeah, I think there's probably like two major topic areas that I would have really liked to dive in a little more on. The first one is just the value of ordinary work and the value of work and how that is really important for us. There's a great book out there by Michael Horton called Ordinary, which I think, you know, may or may not have been written in response to Francis Chan. But the book is essentially like talking about how important it is to find satisfaction and find opportunities to serve God where God has placed us. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really like one of the kind of arguments is like, yeah, it's really good to go to Africa and dig wells. That's a big deal. That's really important. There's a major need. But you know what else is a really major need? When your neighbor's faucet's leaking. You know, and it's not that one is glorifying God and the other isn't. And I think, you know, just like there's you know, pastors that have amazing book deals and are speaking to congregations of thousands, but there's also pastors that are working in obscurity in rural areas that have been serving God faithfully in these, you know, in the pulpits for, you know, 30, 40 years. And I think finding value in that ordinary work is really important. And I think this chapter of Nehemiah kind of connects to that because these are ordinary people. The work they're doing, you know, that's one of the reasons I think Nehemiah lists all their occupations is like, this is God using people where they are with what they're doing for an amazing work for his glory. One quote that comes to mind, I'm not sure who said it, but everybody wants a revolution, but nobody wants to do the dishes. And I really like that. Like there's, you got to get the dishes done. You know, you got to get these.
As somebody who hates doing dishes, yes.
Yeah, it's got to be done. You know, we can't all you know, we really, you know, or an example on a sports team, everybody wants to be quarterback, but a team of quarterbacks is going to do terrible. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think it's really showing the value in recognizing where God has placed us and finding peace and satisfaction with where God has placed us. And seeking to glorify God in our wherever God has placed is really important. And in this chapter, you have, you know, entire families that are working together, and you have sons and daughters, husbands and wives that are, you know, laying aside their perfume making for, you know, 52 days to work on this project together. And I think it's a really incredible and kind of humbling thing, and shows us that our first obligation is the kingdom building. I think that's, you know, that's important. But I think the other thing that shows us is how important it is to serve God where he's placed us and not to always be looking for the greener pastures and looking for these other things. And that isn't to neglect God's calling or say that, you know, God, it's also not to, I don't want to stop people that are ambitious from looking for, I think it is great for people to be looking for greater areas of responsibility. Mm-hmm. But I think the danger is when you can't find satisfaction with where you are. Something that's come up a lot in my work as a camp director at Camp Susquehanna, we get a lot of high school and college students that apply for jobs with us, which I think is, you know, cause we need about 120, staff to run a summer. And, mm-hmm. and just a, if you are listening to this and you know or are a male from the ages of 18 to 24 and you want a summer job, please call me. We could use some Boy Scout counselors. But one of the things I've noticed a lot is we'll get staff that really want leadership positions. And I understand that it's good to have ambition. It's good to want something, but like what I really love and who I'm more likely to give a leadership position to is someone that says, hey, whatever you need, that's what I want to do. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever the camp needs, that's where I want to serve. And I think that should be our posture before God is like, whatever you need, that is what I want to do. And that may mean I'm cleaning out the dung gate, you know, and mm-hmm. this may mean I'm doing these things that are not attractive. They're not getting, you know, and they're not getting a lot of attention. But that is also glorifying to God. And that's really important. A plug for the book Ordinary by Michael Horton is fantastic. It's a really easy read. I think it came out maybe 2012 or so. It's a great book. And I think it's really, really, you know, for me, it really helps me find satisfaction in what I'm doing. And he even uses the example of Nehemiah at one point, but also Paul. I mean, throughout the scripture over and over, there's all these examples of people that, you know, were where they were serving is how they were able to have a huge impact on the kingdom of God. So that's kind of the first point that I think mm-hmm. I would have liked to hit on a little more, because I think that's valuable. And the other one is just how our vocation and how our work creates gospel unity. I think I would have liked to talk about that a little more. And that you're losing a little bit of the context of Nehemiah in that way some more, because we're moving more in just the, you know, concepts of vocation and work. One of the things that I think we fight against in our culture is there's this impression, even in Christian circles, that work is like a necessary evil, you know, that we work so we don't have to work, you know, work is a problem. But the truth is, if you look at scriptures, you know, in Genesis 1, God created work before sin entered the world. You know, work is not inherently mm-hmm. bad.
Yeah.
Yes. Sin made work harder and made it problematic, but work is still important and it's valuable. God created it. It's, and there's blessings in it. And I think, you know, the book Every Good Endeavor by Tim Keller, which is one of my all-time favorite books, he talks, you know, a lot on this topic. But one of the things he drives home is how work unifies us as a body. And an example he uses, there's kind of like this, and I do this when we lead a Bible study on this book, we kind of do a little mind experiment. Like, how many, like if you have a loaf of bread that you buy at the grocery store, how many people did it take to get that loaf of bread to you? You know, you start adding it up and it's hundreds and hundreds of people. Mm-hmm. You know, you're in, okay, well, first there was wheat. Mm-hmm. So someone had to grow the wheat. Well, how many people does it take to grow wheat? You know, on these farms, it's, you know, well, someone provided the seed. Someone had to
till the soil.
Tilling the soil, planting, irrigation. Well, someone also has to, you know, all those tools that were used, those were built by somebody. Mm-hmm. And so let's go with a tractor. How many people did it take to build the tractor that's being mm-hmm. used to make the wheat?
And fix it.
And fix it. Yeah. We can get an iron ore that had to be removed from the earth, turned into iron and, you know, and something like before you even move beyond the wheat, you're probably talking 1,000 people impacted mm-hmm. this bread, you know, and what about the plastic that was used to wrap the bread, you know, and the factory where the bread was made and the transportation between the factory, the farm and the factory and the distribution center and the grocery store, you know, before you know it, you've got, you know, perhaps 10,000 people were involved ultimately in making this bread. And the more you can see the connections between, you know, the product of our work and our work, the more you see that there's that can create unity. Mm-hmm. And I think we're in some ways, because we're this, you know, kind of post-industrial society that is, we're so far removed from the products that we see that we don't get to see the unity that this creates and how this joins us together. Mm-hmm. But if you eat a sandwich, you are, you know, on some level, you are drawing a connection between thousands of people, and that is the culmination of those efforts. But I think that's, you know, it's also really that's on a very huge, crazy level. That's, you know, just kind of a thought experiment. Mm-hmm. But a less crazy one is you think about like our worship service on Sunday morning. You know, it's there's a lot that goes into that worship service. Mm-hmm. You know, yes, Raphael preaches, you know, preaches the word, and he has to prep the sermon, and there's a lot of work involved in that. And then if you dig a little deeper into that, you see, well, he also went to seminary. He also had these mentors. He has these mm-hmm. other people. He might use ChatGPT, which had to be, but he might, he probably uses Logos, which was, you know, programmed by a lot of people. So mm-hmm. there's a lot of work, you know, just to get into a sermon. We already have a lot of people, but then, well, we also have, we sing music. Not even including the people that wrote the music and things like that. We have, you know, Chris has planned the music, or and he and Aubrey and whoever else is involved in deciding what we're playing and when we're playing it and who's playing what and all that. So you have a whole team of people involved in that, not to mention, you know, we could go deeper and, well, they've got these instruments. Those instruments had to be made somewhere. But mm-hmm. But then you also have, we have greeters, you know, and we have a cafe. We have a... You know, so we're serving coffee, we're serving, and we have children, you know, all the children's program, we have people. So if you look at the list of the volunteers for every, or our serve teams every Sunday, it's like 25 to 30 people to help execute a worship service.
And that's not including people that are doing double duty.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot of people that and that's not including all of the work that was done during the week to prep for this either. That's mm-hmm. this is just Sunday morning. It's a lot of people. And I think that's the case for pretty much every church. Mm-hmm. I think in some cases, like, our church has a little more refinement in a lot of these things than maybe some other churches. Like, the church I came from was a little bit smaller, and yeah, we didn't have a cafe. You know, whoever showed up made the coffee, if we had mm-hmm. coffee, you know.
Yeah.
Yep. So this is, you know, perhaps more than average, but still it's, you can't find a church service that isn't dependent on a number of people working together. Mm-hmm. And when you see what that work together produces, that, you know, this corporate worship service that is an offering to God, that is a pleasant smell in God's nose, that's a really incredible thing that draws us together. That is unifying us mm-hmm. through the gospel.
Yeah.
And I think that's, when we looked at the work that was being done in Nehemiah, we see that same thing. All of these people, I mentioned in the sermon that I think there was 28 references to, like, people working beside each other or along each other or behind each other or next to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that indicates these people are working closely together. And I don't know if they all knew each other before this or if they had any connections to each other before this, but they certainly did through this process that is mm-hmm. drawing people together. And
yeah. And if you've ever been on a mission trip, you know that even if you didn't know the person that you went on the mission trip with, by the end of it, you know them really well.
Perhaps too well. It's been,
yes. Yeah.
But I think that, you know, those are kind of the two points. It's just like the value of work, how important work is, and then also how work and our vocations unify us and draw us together. I think those are things I probably would have wanted to draw out a little mm-hmm. more.
Yeah, well, and that reminds me, again, I came, like, growing up, I went to multiple different churches, but in each one of the churches, it seemed like there was an 80-20 distribution. 20% of the people were doing 80% of the work.
Yeah.
And it seems like from...
What's that, the Prada rule or what?
I'm not sure what...
80-20 rule. You find the 80-20 rule everywhere.
Yeah. I don't know where or what it's called. I just know that it's the 80-20 rule.
Yeah.
Or 20-80, however you want to put it. But it seems like what's happening here in this chapter is a complete opposite.
Yeah.
You have 100% of the people doing 100% of the work, where you have...
Well, there's an exception. The nobles of Tekoa. We can get to that, but yeah.
Yes, but I mean, but there were people, and I think you mentioned some sort of high-ranking governing official.
Yeah, there were nobles that were repairing the dung gate. Also, there were governors, there were mayors, there was like the equivalent of mayors, there mm-hmm. were district rulers. Mm-hmm.
But then you had them, and then you had somebody like a perfume maker working side by side next to each other. And I can only assume that was to represent 100% of the community coming together to build something. And in this case, Jerusalem definitely represents the church.
Yeah. Well, the obligation was put on everybody equally.
Yes.
Yeah. There's no one that carried more or less of a burden for this. And I think that's, you know, applicable to us too, because we can't expect, like, the church is not Raphael. Mm-hmm. You know, we love Raphael. We hope he never leaves. We hope he's our pastor forever. At least I do. it's fantastic. But, like, but City Church is not Raphael. Mm-hmm. And it cannot be. And that becomes a real problem. And Nehemiah, the book of Nehemiah, is not about Nehemiah. It is about the amazing work that was accomplished through all of these people. And I think that's, you know, the burden for us is that we all have an obligation to City Church, or more important, we all have an obligation to the Church Universal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's our, you know, if there's anything we draw from Nehemiah, we need to remember from this passage specifically, is that's our first obligation.
Yeah.
Those other occupations, those other things, those are secondary, you know, because when our first responsibility is to God's kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And then our occupations are, that's one of the mechanisms that we use to serve God's kingdom.
Yeah, yeah. And which was a good point, because I was going to bring up, and we talked about it a little bit last night at our home group, was that just because you're not in vocational ministry or full-time ministry, doesn't mean that your full-time job isn't ministry in and of itself.
Right.
Like I think my wife, she's a physical therapist assistant, and she's like, God has called me to, which I think you made a really good point talking about vocare and how that is our, which means calling.
I did not try to pronounce it during this sermon.
I'm hoping
that might be right.
The very Latin, small right? Latin that I've done on Duolingo has has like translated a little bit, but it means to call.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's where we get our word vocation. So her vocation being, or her calling being, physical therapy assistant is just making people's quality of life better. And that is promoting human flourishing, which is exactly what the Bible's calling us to do.
Yeah.
It's like your vocation can very easily just be ministry in and of itself in a very tangible, practical way.
Yeah. Well, I think there's kind of two ways to look at that too. Like, one way is you can draw very clear connections to ministry if you are able to evangelize at your work, if you're able to build relationships with people, and like, and then the secondary thing would be also like you are giving gifts to the church and to Christian organizations through the wages that you earn at these works. But I think what's sometimes missed is that doing your job well is glorifying to God.
Mm-hmm.
Like, God wants us to do our jobs well. He's given us these gifts. We are image bearers. Mm-hmm. We are bearing our image as we're making good perfume. We are bearing we are showing off his image as we're helping someone with their physical therapy. And that is very important. And that's part of, that's why it's our calling. It's not just a means to an end. I think so many times we look at our work as we just want to get the money so we can do the things we want to do.
Mm-hmm.
There is value and meaning in the work itself and the work that's under the work. And I think that's, what our culture is absolutely missed. I mean, like, collectively in American culture, this is a very broad generalization, but I think people want to work so that they don't have to work.
Yeah.
That is working for the weekend. That's one thing. But also, like, I want to retire as soon as possible because then I can really enjoy life.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that attitude has it all wrong. Like, our work is, we need to find enjoyment in our work. That's what work is hard. Sin has made it harder. There are problems with work. There are there are systemic issues, way sin has impacted work. But that doesn't change the fact that work is a gift from God that we are expected to participate in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know that you have a philosophy. Your undergrad was philosophy, right?
I try to keep that under wraps, but yes. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not a bad thing.
Tyler, it is absolutely a bad... Anyone listening, unless you are planning to be a lawyer, do not get a degree in philosophy. Do something better. I guess you could edit that out if you want to later, but...
No.
But yes, I do have a degree in philosophy.
So, philosophers are, I think, really good... really good examples of what lifetime vocation is. Because, like, Richard Swinburne at Oxford, he's a prolific Christian philosopher who has, I think he's got 50 plus years in some sort of teaching professorship role.
Mm.
But he's got an emeritus professorship at Oxford right now. So he's not actively teaching, but he's actively doing work.
Mm-hmm.
So he's retired from his full-time vocation as a professor, but that doesn't mean that he stopped doing the work that God has called him to do. And I think even how whatever your view on philosophy is as a Christian, you can easily take a really good example from Christian philosophers and Christian ministers who are just, they love what they do. And just because they're not getting actively paid for it right now doesn't mean they stop doing
it. Yeah. Yeah. Once we hit retirement age or whatever, that doesn't eliminate our obligations to continue working. It, it might be a different form of work. I mean, some of the men I respect the most are more busy in their retirement than they were when they were working. I have a wonderful friend who is, I mean, I think he's less available now that he's retired. I think like he's because he's found so many ways to be involved in the community and in people's families and in his church and things like that, that that's where he's like, I'm so glad I'm retired because I'm able to do so much more for God's kingdom now. It's it's, but I think that's the thing. Yeah. I think we have this impression that, oh no, retirement is for rest and vacations. And that's it's a change of life for sure.
Yeah.
But I think the goal, I think the goal of so many is we work so that we can rest. And we elevate rest as such a good thing and work as such a bad thing. And that's backwards. I mean, rest is a good thing, but it's, I think the equation of how much rest versus how much work, we get that wrong most of the time.
Yeah. And, we were talking beforehand, just kind of about certain theological positions that we hold. And I don't want to get into that, but it, it just kind of brings to mind the days of creation. God spent so much time working. At the very least, he spent 6 days.
Yeah.
Six literal days. And then he rested. It's like the emphasis there is not on the culmination of it.
Yeah.
It is, hey, this is good. If it wasn't good, I wouldn't be doing it.
Yeah.
Because God can't do anything that's bad or evil or anything like that. He has to stay consistent with his nature. So if God is doing work and it's, and God is consistent, then work is good.
Yeah. So, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's, we get the equation and the balance wrong. I mean, I think we go both ways too. I mean, Americans and, you know, I'm myself, I'm guilty of this, but I think a lot of people, we work too much too. You know, we don't have appropriate rhythms of rest and we don't care for ourselves appropriately to manage that. But I think, we swing the pendulum back and forth. And but I think even in those times when we're working really hard and we're not resting appropriately, we're still putting that rest up as an idol instead of a and like, oh, I can, if I just do these additional hours of overtime or whatever, then I can really like cash in on my rest. And that's, I don't know. I think we collectively, in America, at least, and I think in a lot of other countries, we have it wrong. Now, an interesting thing, our weekend, Tyler, this is a kind of unrelated to the topic, but this is just a factoid for you. The reason we celebrate a 2-day weekend is because of religious tolerance. This is back in early on in America's history. It started in Philadelphia. This is, you know, we can thank Ben Franklin and Count Zinzendorf and a few others. There were a number of men who were very concerned. Well, there was both, get this wrong. There were a few Christian sects that still celebrate a Saturday Sabbath instead of a Sunday Sabbath. And there was a number of people that thought, hey, we want to honor them and not provide a, be a burden to them. So we will take Saturdays off as well. And it became a national phenomenon that our essentially Monday through Friday work week was a result of religious tolerance. I think it's kind of interesting.
Which I think is a really cool, I think it's really cool just to think about, but to also give people a little bit of an option. Yeah. So someone like Raphael, for instance, who he works on Sunday. There's literally no way for him to not work on a Sunday because that would kind of eliminate him from the pastoral role that he's in. So he takes a different day off, whether that's Saturday or Monday or Wednesday, it doesn't really matter. But it still is really cool to see like, hey, we're giving accommodations for people to take a rest day whenever they need it.
Yeah.
And if that is Saturday, if it's Sunday or Friday, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. And I also like that, you know, I think a 2-day weekend, very practically, hopefully, one of the ways we can use it is to eliminate the temptation not to take a Christian Sabbath, essentially. Mm-hmm. And I'm not like a strong Sabbatarian here that says, oh, you cannot work. But I do think that, you know, Sunday is set apart. It is separate. It is supposed to be special. We do worship, you know, we do our corporate worship on Sunday. And I think we should make that very important. And all these other things of life can often intrude on that. Mm-hmm. But I think having Saturday as not a typical work day helps lower that pressure. And, you know, we can still keep Sunday sacred mm-hmm. in some ways. And I think that's important too. And, but I really love, that we do. I think it's neat that we have 2-day weekends in America and that I also hope that we can use that to elevate the importance of worshiping together on Sundays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just in general, rest. Because I'm sure, because these are observant Jews, the Sabbath was built into their work week. But I highly doubt that if they were to just work continuously, that they would have been able to finish when they did.
Yeah.
They would have burnt out.
Yeah.
And
it's protect. This is God's love for us and protecting us as well to have these rhythms of life that are mm-hmm. appropriate for, you know, balancing all of the things we need to balance.
Yeah, and it provides us, and Raphael's going to love me for this, for bringing resiliency into all of this. But it provides us with a certain level of resiliency, so whenever we get up on Monday, we're ready to go. I know that there's the Sunday, or the Sunday evening jitters and the like anxieties that, like, I don't know what I'm going to walk into on Monday whenever I see the schedule or whatever, and what I have to do. But having a set period of rest where you can take a step back and breathe and really focus on God gives you that resiliency to be able to say, yes, I don't know what I'm walking into, but whatever it is, I'm going to be able to handle it.
Yeah. And I think what you see in Nehemiah too, prior to a lot of the reforms that are taken in, is you see what happens when we don't have an elevation of God's word. We don't have an elevation of serving God in corporate worship, and things fall apart. Mm-hmm. You know, because this is God providing the sacrificial system, God providing the temple, God providing even the tithes. You know, we've talked about this in the past too. Mm-hmm. Like all of these things, those were a blessing. And the Sabbath requirements, those were a blessing to the people, not a burden. Those were a way that you could order your lives appropriately so that you could have more, so you'd be more effective in your vocation. Mm-hmm. So you'd be more effective worshipers. So you'd be more effective as families. And so you could, you know, appropriately set God as the pinnacle. This is what I want to serve. And all of those systems that God created in the Old Testament were to design people's lives around the thing they should be, you know, designed around. It's designed around the worship of God. That's the most important thing. And I think that's, you know, when you look at all the reforms that Nehemiah is pursuing through the book of Nehemiah and through the book of Ezra, that's what they're trying to get back to. Because mm-hmm. Everything had fallen apart. They didn't have all of those protections built in. So that means that people are more likely to fall astray. When you're not hearing God's word regularly, when, you know, there was intermarrying with other countries in Ezra. This is a big, you know, even kind of crazy part of Ezra and Nehemiah. You had these scenarios where would these have happened if you had your lives ordered around corporate worship, ordered around the temple? And we see the example that yes, you do. You still have those things happen. we have the example of the Israelites doing this over and over. But still, these were built-in protections for the people to avoid all of these pitfalls and the temptations that's surrounding them. Mm-hmm. This is to, you know, we want to get our loves ordered correctly. We want to get our relationships put in the right categories, and the temple system, the feasts, the calendar, everything that God provided were there for the purpose of ordering people's lives so that they're pointed toward God and therefore toward Christ.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which... it's just a good reminder, I think, to just make sure that we're making our life ordered in a sense of what needs to be first stays first. Mm-hmm. and then things will fall into place.
Yeah.
After that. And I'm working on getting more ordered in my life, with some of the situations that I deal with at work. Mm-hmm. This semester has been crazy. So it's like, I've had to like kind of reorder how I do things. But that doesn't mean that I'm not seeking to create order within yeah. the crazy hectic life that is the 21st century life. Cause we're also talking about AI and mm-hmm. how, and just the technology advances and how we're inundated with all of these things. But yet that creates the sense of like, oh no, there's so much like,
or even like, right now, as we're yeah. talking, Facebook is down, or there's issues with Facebook, which yeah. is probably causing a little bit of low key anxiety for both of us because yeah. we can't check our messages or our notifications. Mm-hmm. But, yeah. but I do think that like, yeah, it's really hard to get your life in order. So the key is you got to get your first priority first. Mm-hmm. Cause I think if you've got that right, I'm not saying everything falls into place in a neat little package.
No.
But you've got, if you don't start with the top right, you're not going to get anything right.
Yes.
And I think that's the real, and if you get the top wrong, everything is going to be wrong. But if you get the top right, if your absolute priority, your number one is serving God and loving God, mm-hmm. the likelihood that other things are going to fall into place, that they at least have the opportunity to fall into the right places. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying we're always going to get it right all the time.
Yeah.
But getting that, but if you don't get that top thing right, everything will be wrong.
Yes. Yeah. So total, I guess maybe not tangent, kind of falls into the whole ordering and kind of having like a plan. Because mm-hmm. you brought up a plan that they had this building plan essentially. Because yeah.
kudos to Joe for talking through that awesome leadership stuff the previous week. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. But that reminded me of what is called the teleological argument. And just basically it's an argument from design that there's a design and an order to the world that we live in. And that when our...
Way more convincing than the ontological argument, I think. But anyhow, we could...
I'll let you take that one up with Gavin Ortland. Because he really likes that one. I do too.
I like them all. Either that comforts me that, okay, I'm worshiping God and that's a good thing. It's yeah. helpful.
That's the philosopher in you.
Yeah, maybe.
But the whole idea of there being some sort of design in the world, and that when we're building something, for instance, and there's no design, things fall apart.
Yeah.
But whenever there is a design, as Nehemiah set forward for them, however he got the design, or if he yeah. was just building on what was previously there and just quite literally rebuilding it, that there's still a design there, and yeah. following that design is a good thing.
I think bringing order out of chaos is mm-hmm, part of mm-hmm. that's creation. That's one of the ways we reflect God's image in that.
Yeah, yeah.
We are. I would say it's almost a creation mandate that's part of our job as image bearers mm-hmm. is to be creative and yeah. to bring order from disorder.
Yeah, yeah, and that was just kind of cool to see. To see something that seems so distant from us, we hear things about, oh, that the universe is super finely tuned. But that, for a lot of us, that just seems so distant because it's not something we can tangibly touch. Mm-hmm. But yet, when our lives are ordered in a certain plan that is in accordance with God's plan, everything goes the way it's supposed to go. Yeah. And that's just like a direct translation. It's just on a... almost like a microscopic scale of our yeah. lives rather than the whole universe and the cosmos. Yeah. So one of the other things, and you've mentioned this in the past, mm-hmm. About stepping down from a position that you've had mm-hmm. and moving into where you're at now. And Nehemiah kind of did the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a big deal too. Cause we talk about Nehemiah being a type of Christ, and I think he is. And I'm going to give a spoiler to whoever has a future. This is something I did not hit on in the sermon, but kind of wanted to, because I think this is really powerful too. But yeah, we have a number of ways Nehemiah is an example of Christ. I mean, mm-hmm. first of all, he leaves. He leaves the king's court to come and work in a rubble-strewn city. I mean, that's obviously that's not the same as Jesus coming down from heaven, but it's a there's a connection there, a strong one.
There's a parallel.
Yeah, and he also like he Nehemiah very literally kicks money changers out of the temple later on. I mean, he institutes a lot of these reforms, and he sees and he also he cares for he makes a lot of provisions for the underserved in the book of Nehemiah. There's a lot of these things, but then I think what really stands out to me is at one point he's working on the wall, and Sanballat and these other opposite, they're yelling to him, and they're saying, "Hey, come down off that wall. Come talk to us. Come down off the wall and talk to us. We just want to talk to you." And now, like, you know, Nehemiah knows this is a plot of some sort. They're trying to get him, you know, because they've clearly been his opposition the whole time, but they keep telling him, like, "Come down off the wall so I can talk to you. Come down from there." And he says, "I can't come down. This work is too important." And then there's this scene of Jesus on the cross when they're jeering at him and say, "Hey, if you're really the Son of God, come down from there. You know, come off the cross, come down from here."
Yeah.
And that's so similar to Nehemiah. But Jesus, he doesn't come down because his work is too important. Mm-hmm. He knows his work is important. He knows this is the work that his Father has been given to him, and he has to complete that. And he's not going to be distracted from it. He's not going to take any other. And so you have Nehemiah and Jesus like almost saying the same phrase, like, I'm not coming down, even though they've been, and I think that's another way he's a type of Christ. But then, you know, just like the entire book of Nehemiah is unfortunately more tragic than successful. And this is, you know, you have Jesus at the end saying it is finished. But you have this other cry from Nehemiah at the end where he's just screaming out to God, crying, "God, remember me for what I've done," because it's not finished. Like he's not, like he doesn't see any completion. Yeah. He doesn't see any, he gets no satisfaction because everything he sees falls apart. But that's to point us towards a better Nehemiah. We get to see Christ where Christ actually accomplishes it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't want to promote necessarily that in order to serve God, you need to leave the job that you have, no matter how cushy your job is. It could be, you could be like the CEO of a Fortune 500 company and serving God in that role.
Absolutely.
But that doesn't mean that you give up your job there and go serve kids in India.
Right.
It's like, there's ways that you can serve God with the skills that you've been given in that role. So don't think that just because it's in the Bible that there's a mandate to do so.
Right.
Because I think that's one of the things that we as humans tend to do is that we see, oh, this is in the Bible. I'm a Christian, therefore I have to do it.
Well, and I think kind of a distinguishing feature of what Nehemiah did too is I think Nehemiah actually did. He used his position to serve God. In some ways, he actually didn't leave his position. He became governor essentially of this land east or west of the Euphrates. He actually was given a very important role by the king to do this. But it was because he was in that position in the king's court, because he had that friendship with the king, that he was able to accomplish any of these things.
He definitely
you know, he went down and lived in Jerusalem. It took a major lifestyle downgrade, no doubt.
Oh, yeah.
But I do think, like, I think, if anything, we should look at that and be like, how has this place where God has put me created an obligation for God's people? And that's what the question we should be asking ourselves. Not, do I need to, resign from this job and go, hang on the streets or whatever. I'm not, absolutely, I don't think we have to do that. I don't think we're called to do that. But I think what we are called to do, and this is absolutely crucial, is wherever we are, we should be looking at our job, looking at our vocation, looking at our family, looking at our church, looking at all the elements of our life and trying to figure out, like, how is this serving God? And if it's not serving God, if you can't find those connections, then maybe you do need a change. But I think most likely is you can see that, like, if wherever I am, there's an obligation to serve God, and I can.
Yeah. And I want to leave that there to end, because that's a really impactful statement, because wherever you are, you can serve God.
Yeah. And more importantly, you must.
Yes.
Yeah. You have wherever you are, mm-hmm. wherever God has placed you, you have your first and primary obligation is not to the company that you work for. It's to the God that you serve.
Yes. Yeah. So with that, I just want to remind all of you who are listening that this isn't a replacement for the Sunday sermon. If you missed the Sunday sermon, go one podcast behind this and you'll get to hear Peter not butcher all of the names. We left somebody else to do that. So, but it's also not a replacement for being in a Sunday service, involved in a local church. We would love to see you do that because that's where we're honed. That's where we are sent out from there so that we can serve God in the roles that he has placed us in. So think of it more as this is more of a vitamin than it is anything else. Peter, thank you for walking us through all of chapter 3 and for setting us up for a good bit of the next section of Nehemiah. So we will see you all next week.